How many employees were there when you were at Swiggy?
So when we were at Swiggy, there were around maybe 300-350 employees. Obviously, there is a large customer support team, but the core business team was around 300-350.
And when you left Swiggy, I think in 2019, do you have any idea how big the team was?
Oh, then when I left Swiggy, then my team itself was 350. So I think we were 1,500 plus.
Understood. And this was in a span of 2 years, is it? Two and a half years, right?
This is 2.5 years, yes.
Understood. So I am familiar that I think when you joined Swiggy, I think it was around in 9 cities. And I think when you left, it was in 500 cities. And I think you also had a role to play in that. Could you maybe, very curious as to how does that journey or how does that journey of scaling to multiple cities start? I mean, so 9 and 500, it's a huge difference, right? It's a huge multiples. So what was the strategy in the sense, like, were you there when they were making the scaling strategy that we have to expand to X number of cities, or what was the plan going on? Was there discussion of, let's scale slowly, let's only go into, let's say, you know, let's go to the next 15 cities, then 30 cities, and then maybe slowly scale? What was the discussion? Can you walk me through that?
Yeah, so I think when I joined, we were basically in top 6 or 7 cities, and there was a team which was getting built in parallel when I joined to launch 4 cities, 1 city at a time. And Swiggy's goal was always to do 1 city at a time. I remember this very vividly because for a brief period of time before doing my startup, I was at Tinyhub, which was also another food delivery company. And at that point in time, I think Tinyhub was already in some 10-15 cities, and Swiggy was only in 1 city, which was in Bangalore. And they were planning to come to Bombay very slowly. And I was very surprised what Swiggy achieved, because we are always told that go build fast, break things, learn. But Swiggy was doing completely opposite, right? They were working, they were opening 1 area at a time in a particular city, onboarding all those restaurants, getting those delivery boys right, launching is doing the marketing. So when I joined, I think we were in 6-7 cities, and the plan was to launch 3 more cities. I remember, I think one was Chandigarh, another was Jaipur, and maybe third one was Kochi. I don't remember exactly. And there was a team which was getting built based out of Jaipur, Chandigarh, and Kochi. And this team took 6 to 9 months to launch the first city, right? That individual city. Obviously, these three cities were working in launching in parallel, but it took us 6 months to do that, right? And we were onboarding each and every restaurant, and the focus was to get the right customer experience. And everything, and that was a thought process.
I'm sorry. So just to stop you here, in the sense that if you can walk us through what does onboarding for one city look like? Like, what does that mean? Like, when you, let's say you want to, let's say, onboard Ahmedabad tomorrow. Swiggy is not on Ahmedabad, and now you want to onboard Ahmedabad. So what happens next? Like, you know, do you set up a team in Ahmedabad? Who goes and talks to the restaurants? Like, how do you guys get delivery? Like, what's that step by step?
So there are 4 key pillars to launching any city for Swiggy. One was setting up the team, and this team has to be a good combination of people from Ahmedabad plus people from the HQ who have seen the other cities also, right? Because learnings have to flow. That is one. Second pillar was the restaurants, which is the supplier, like onboarding the restaurants. Obviously, it's very easy that you have the restaurants listed on Zomato, so you just go and scrape that and start talking to some of those restaurants. But what we were also doing, interestingly, is because Swiggy was already famous, and a lot of people in Ahmedabad were downloading the app and searching for specific restaurants, and those restaurants were not there because Swiggy was not there. So we were capturing all those searches data and talking to all those customers and asking them which are the restaurants that they want to be onboarded on Swiggy first. So that was the second pillar that we focused on. Third pillar is the delivery boys. In terms of how do you get delivery boys, what is the work culture, what is the DNA, what are the expectations of the delivery boys?
I'm so sorry. Again, just on the, Really, I mean, I'm finding that a little hard to believe, in the sense that for work culture in delivery boys, I mean, mostly my impression is because I think most of the delivery boys, let's not stick to maybe Swiggy itself, but any you take, Zomato, Dunzo, I mean, my impression is these people stay only for, a small period of time, and then they move on to maybe some other gigs. So is there really a discussion about, you know, work culture in terms of delivery boys and all this?
It's not so much about the work culture. It's also about the expectations. And obviously, when we were talking in 2017, 2018 time, right? There were only few delivery businesses which were there. I think the market has changed a lot after that, where Dunzo came in, Zepto came in, and then people were jumping from one job to another job. At that point in time, obviously doing delivery as a business was also not very prestigious, right? That what are you doing? Are you doing delivery? So we also wanted to make it look like a company, you are part of the culture and everything. What are people's expectations? How much do they want to spend every hour? What is their expectations around earnings? How much does it cost to stay in a particular city like Ahmedabad, because it will vary city to city. So because that we use to define one very important metric in the whole delivery business, which is called CPD, the cost per delivery, like what we pay to the delivery boys. So for all of this, understanding the behavior of these delivery boys, the how do they earn, what do they work, was also very critical. And that's why we wanted somebody locally who can talk that language, who can understand, build that connect with those people.
And I'm curious, when these delivery people get hired, I mean, does Swiggy, like, I don't know if you're familiar with it now, but in general, like, do these companies have something in-house, or do they generally outsource the hiring for, let's say, delivery guys? Or does that all happen in-house?
No. So everything was outsourced. There were a few delivery boys that we were hiring in-house as well. But obviously, those were special cases. I'll give you some examples that when we launched Starbucks, right? So we wanted to appoint delivery full-time there because we have to give a very special experience when it comes to Starbucks, that as soon as you order, the order gets picked up and gets delivered. And that delivery boy is trained to just manage the coffee deliveries, right? So in such cases, we get in-house as well. So there are some nuances in which we do that, but 99% of that was outsourced.
Understood. Do these things that you mentioned in the beginning, you had like these four things that you would kind of focus on, would these scale to every city, or broadly would they scale, or are there like, do you have to come up with a new game plan for like most maybe tier three cities?
This was scalable as we go from maybe 7 cities to 20 cities or 30 cities. This wasn't a scalable plan to go to 500 cities. That too, if the plan was to launch 500 cities in maybe less than 6 to 8 months. So you can't have the same approach of launching one city at a time, looking at the data, analyzing, talking to them, right? So the plan has to change massively. Also, I think economies of scale and the brand awareness about the Swiggy and everything also starts building up. So you don't have to teach a lot to delivery boys. You don't have to teach a lot to the restaurant owners that who is Swiggy, why do they have to associate with us, how does it work and everything, right? So in some aspect, it becomes faster. But in some aspect, in terms of very remote connectivity, remote places, you don't have some pockets will work at night, how do they work in the morning, do they have enough supply, how the city nuances around, is it a breakfast heavy city, is it a late night heavy city. Some of those aspects will start varying significantly as you go to a remote, like not remote, but tier 2 cities in Chhattisgarh versus tier 2 cities in Maharashtra versus tier 2 cities in Rajasthan, right? So city level nuances will start kicking in. So that becomes very critical. So our game plan had to change massively post 30 cities.
How big of a factor is that? I mean, Is that a big factor? Let's say when if one city is like mostly breakfast heavy, or you know, they ignore breakfast and they have, let's say, their main meal, let's say, is lunch, and you know, you get a lot of orders. Is that a big factor while scaling up or introducing Swiggy to?
Yeah, it is a big factor, and I'll tell you why. It's not only because of how we were launching the city, because in parallel, Zomato was also launching all these cities, right? And in these smaller cities, when we were launching, right, a first mover, like if you really don't do it right in the first go, getting the market share in that city becomes very tricky. And that's why for us, I still remember in my hometown when we were launching Swiggy, we didn't have a lot of good restaurants onto our platform because whatever, we missed out on certain things. And Zomato had. And still, it becomes difficult after 2, 3, 4 years to gain the market share on those cities, because in such cities, people don't really switch because there is no huge delta in terms of experience in smaller cities, right? Even if it is Zomato or Swiggy, you will still get the order at the same time. The time-wise, there is no delta. So the first, the plan, the go-to-market in those cities becomes very critical.
I think I can relate to this. I'm not sure how much, but, because again, this is not like a plug for Swiggy, but I only use Swiggy, and that's only mostly because I mean, it's not like I have some any sentimental value towards Swiggy. It's mostly because my sister made the account on Swiggy, and so she used to order it for me, and then she handed the account over to me, and I never bothered installing Zomato. So it's not like I love Swiggy per se, but just because somebody made the account for me and I get my food, it's just my defaults. I've never bothered installing Zomato. I don't care what the discount is on Zomato. If I'm getting like 20 rupees lower on my Death by Chocolate, I don't care. So yeah.
And we realized this not on the first go. I think we made a bunch of mistakes to realize this, but then that was the game plan, that how do you do it? And that's where, when we started launching cities, we realized, and we have actually launched cities only on the weekends, lunch and dinner, right? That was also a plan of launching the cities, because you have to move fast, right? Get those customers faster. Zomato is also moving fast. So what are the different ways in which you can do it so that you have that 80% of the work done, 20% of the work can get done over the next set of time, right? So we were only launching few slots. We were only launching for a few days. That was also another game plan that we had at that point in time.
But that can be very annoying, no? Like, because as a customer, like, if I don't know, if you're telling me that you're only available Friday, like, I mean, I'm like, what is this nonsense? Like, why?
Exactly, because you're staying in Kormangla, right? We are so used to 24/7. And that's where for launching Bangalore, where delivery till 4 a.m. in the night was a very easy choice, because there are people who wanted this. But when you go to cities like Bilaspur, or we went to very remote places as well, because 500 cities, right? People have habit of going out or eating out only on the weekends, right? So weekday eating out, ordering is not a culture. It's a set part. If you are doing this, then there is also a belief that the house is not running correctly, the housewives are not doing their work properly. So there are a lot of such things which kick in. And that's where in some places, not obviously all the places, the plan was that, okay, this weekend we are launching and we have such offers, right? Get users, start building, start, and then start doing this. Because also a lot of people who were delivery boys, right, were available only on weekends. Because during weekdays, they are into some shops or doing their own some business. So doing that was very quick for us to go and test the waters. It's not like you will go and launch 500 cities and keep running it. We also launched a lot of cities and had to roll back because there is no enough business. It's not viable. So what is the fastest way to dip your toe, understand how it is, and then build a long-term?
Any idea how much it costs to experiment on that? Like, I mean, if I go to one city, if Swiggy or Zomato goes to one city and has to roll back, any idea how much that costs?
Oh, I don't have a exact sense, but we were pretty light. Like, for example, when we were doing such experiments, is the remote team that was going, staying in that city for a week, launching that city remote, like launching that city without an office and anything. So the only expense was the team traveling, staying, onboarding some of these delivery boys, handing over them the t-shirts and the delivery bags. That's all. And some marketing that we had to do.
So but sort of is 1 week. But sort of is 1 week enough data to conclude? Don't you think that's a little?
No. So I'm saying the cost of launching was this. Obviously, we used to stay for a week, launch it, then maybe a few people come back, and then remaining it is very autopilot, right? You, nobody needs to be there once the delivery boys and the restaurants are trained, and that's what, right? I think we also realized that over time people understood. How the they have to accept the orders, how the delivery has to be done. So we don't have to stay there. Obviously, we never shut down the city maybe in less than a couple of months. So at least we ran the city for a couple of months to see and build the make the best effort to make that city work. But yeah, but I think after a couple of months of efforts, there were a lot of cities where we had to shut.
What is the most, like, what is a consistent bottleneck in every, or not every, but most cities where you went to, where that was like the key thing that you had to figure out or else everything would like fall apart? Was there something like that?
The delivery experience was the most painful task. Training the delivery boys on that once you reach the restaurant, you'll have to click that, okay, I have reached the restaurant. Take the order properly, check the order properly against the bill. Because there could be some items missing. Then put it properly and deliver without spilling. Don't call the customers constantly, where is the order, like, where is your address? So I think training the whole delivery boy is the most complex aspect in launching the city. I think the easiest part is to get the restaurants on board and get the customers on.
Just on the restaurant. So how does the restaurant onboarding work? Like, I mean, do you send out a team to, like, you know, show them? Is it like the physical, we have this app called Swiggy. It'll do, I mean, it'll be nice for you to join it. You'll get, is that the sales? Like, I mean, is it like the physical thing?
Yeah, it's mostly physical, obviously, for the lot of big cities because restaurant owners don't have time. But for a lot of small cities, what we had done is we know what is our calendar of launching the cities. We started calling the restaurants 3 to 4 weeks earlier. From Bangalore itself to explain that, hey, we are coming to your city and this is how Swiggy works, this is the commercials and everything. A lot of commercials and everything used to get signed online as well. So the only task for the team which was going and launching is to go put the merchandises.
I'm so sorry. I don't know if you can discuss this, but I didn't understand. Like commercials in the sense, like what kind of commercials?
Like you have commercials with the restaurants, right? Like for example, if how much order have you get, what is the commissions that the Zomato or Swiggy will earn from that?
Oh, it's not for every order, is it? It's for a bunch of orders, is it? Like
no, it's for every order, but that commercial has to be signed.
Understood. Sorry, my bad. Sorry. Okay.
Because it varies restaurant by restaurant.
So if it's like a restaurant is already doing well, then maybe they have the leverage and.
Sometimes they have the leverage, sometimes you have the leverage. Then there are a lot of small nuances in terms of when the promotion happens, how it will work, when the campaigns happen, how it works. So those nuances will also get mentioned.
But I think now, I think all the leverage is with Swiggy or these Swiggy or Zomato, right? I think most, because they have the distribution sorted out, it'll be very difficult for me as a...
I don't know what's... for the last 4 or 5 years, but I'm sure, like, because they have the customers, so they have the business with them, right? So
yeah, right. Any other thing on scaling? Because any other thing on scaling that I missed, maybe that was very crucial for you guys to.
So I think for us the important piece was. The most important part for me was to manage some of these things in parallel, having the right systems in place. Initially, the tech systems and everything that was built at Swiggy was not for that kind of a scale because it goes through rigorous testing before launching the city. You have to create maps and everything, right? So technical systems were not in place. So what we realize is even if how much ever you plan before start the scaling, things will still break but having the right stakeholders and processes in place so that you can still course correct some of those things was the important piece. The idea was also to do it very, having a lean team for scale, right? So we were not initially from the beginning, we were very conscious of the fact that we don't want to have a large team who is
Right. I'm so sorry. So just to polish that a little bit. So in the sense that when the scaling happened in like 6 to 9 months, so was there like, so there was a team appointed? Was it like a scaling or growth or scaling team? Is it like, is that how it works?
Yeah. So there is a scaling team, which was almost 300-350 members, which was running across different cities and doing some of the operational work on the ground, setting up some of the processes. Wherever things are breaking, you have to travel back and sort those things out, kind of a things. Creating campaigns in-house when you are launching the cities, where are the promotions happening? So working with the central marketing team to ensure that, okay, let's say this X particular city is launched, now you start the campaigns. Then you monitor what are the campaigns to run in those cities. How do you identify frauds is a big task. Because every new city is a new challenge. There are different type of frauds which are happening on the delivery boy side, or the restaurant side, or the customer side. So you need to see those things.
Yes. Initially, was there a lot of pushback from, was it easy to convince these restaurant owners to get on the app, or was it difficult to, was there a lot of pushback?
So initially, I think when we were doing initially 30, 50 cities, it was a lot of pushback from the restaurant because they didn't know Swiggy a lot. They were not sure about the potential there. But when, as we started going to the smaller cities, it was very easy for us. The only pushback was majorly from our side because we wanted them to follow a particular hygiene of packaging the order, handing over the order, ensuring that they don't change the prices, right? Price parity is the most important thing. And what we have seen restaurant used to do is they used to just increase the price because there is some commission that they have to pay to the Swiggy. They will, for their online menu, used to increase the price. There used to be disparity between what is the price on Zomato versus what is the price on Swiggy. For a customer, it's very easy to identify that difference. So working those things and smoothing some of those edges was the critical task. But convincing them to come on to Swiggy was not.
How much was Zomato on your minds? Like, was Zomato a big threat back then?
Oh, yeah. Zomato was, and we were very closely monitoring what Zomato was doing, which cities are launching, what has been the performance in those cities, what is working, what is not working. And I'm sure they were also doing the same thing.
Were you guys the top two players, or because if I remember the food business, I think there were a lot of players, and I mean, now it's
a duopoly. Yeah. There was Foodpanda, there were Uber Eats, but I think they were not the major threats, obviously, because they were also not scaling so massively. They never scaled to 500 kind of a city. Maybe they were in maybe 10, 15, 20 kind of cities, and that was not the battle that we were fighting right now. Our battle was majorly with Zomato when we were scaling.
Why do you think Swiggy has not IPO'd?
I think a lot has changed from since I have left. When I was there, there was not even a conversation about IPO. So I have no clue, but I'm eagerly waiting for Swiggy to do the IPO.
Understood. Because I'm not sure if you'll be eager, because I think Zomato's market share has, I think, dropped significantly since the IPO. Anyways. So you were, as I started, you were director of business, and then you were vice president. We obviously touched upon this. But what does that role mean? Like, I mean, now if I can take the assistant vice president role, so like, what does that mean? Like, I mean, like, what do you get to do?
Oh, so I think the major difference, work-wise, nothing changes, but you have a lot of ownership on delivering things, right? As you grow up. So when I was doing the AVP role, the responsibility I had was to manage the P&L of what we call as India 2, which is 30 cities and beyond. You are responsible for the P&L. So nobody's constantly mentoring or guiding you what needs to be done. You are actually pretty much on your own. So I think that was the major difference for me, that you have to figure out your own pieces. And then, yeah, and you just given a large, given a task that you have to deliver, given a target that you have to deliver.
Do you have any, like, what was Swiggy culture like back then? Like, I mean, when you joined and maybe when you left as well, like, do you have an idea of, could you maybe paint a picture of, like, you know, what was the culture back then?
Oh, so Swiggy for me, I think one thing stood out was a very high talent density. The kind of team that the initial team that founders have built was the pivotal part of what Swiggy is doing today. Because that team that was initially hired attracted a lot of similar folks. And I believe that is the smartest team that I've ever worked with. Everybody had a very high ownership and freedom to go try, experiment, make mistakes, come back and share the learnings was the most critical part. Nobody was really micromanaged in Swiggy. I think micromanagement in Swiggy is unheard of when I was there.
Understood. You mentioned that one of the reasons your first startup failed was due to not building the right team. Can you walk me through on the ground what happens if you do not build the right team, and what have you learned about building the right teams maybe from your experience?
Sure. So I will tell you what happened at Truce, which was my first startup. We had raised small funds and we were very cost conscious while building the team. And we had certain jobs to be done and the opening, like we had some openings for those roles. We looked for people who were just good enough for that specific role. We never looked at scalability of those people, right? And they were doing that role perfectly fine. But when things started scaling up, those people couldn't scale. And then what happened is things started breaking, and without you too much realizing, you get so much sucked into the day-to-day operations, right? And me and my co-founder both got sucked into managing things which started breaking as things were scaling. To keep the things together. And just part of doing that, we missed out the whole tangent that the business that we are into, which was delivering from farmers to the restaurant, which was at that point in time was not scaling as we expected, but there is a Swiggy and Zomato business which is scaling, and that's why restaurants are adopting tech. They want some suppliers like us. So we missed that whole tangent that, oh, this could be a big growth that is coming for us. And before that, we just shut the shop. And that happened because we didn't have enough time to think, see it from the outside in perspective.
So when you say your teammates or the employees are not, with the scale of your company, the employees are not able to scale. What I understood is like, they're not able to handle the business at a larger scale, is it? I mean, the responsibilities that come with scale, they're not able to kind of cope with it, is it?
Yeah,
is that...
adaptability is a bigger problem, right? Like, for example, scale does not mean that doing the same thing 10 times. Scale means it will have different challenges, certain things which are not breaking at scale 1 will start suddenly breaking at scale 3. I would start breaking. How do you solve that? Do you have that problem solving mindset or not? So certain things like that becomes very important. So how people are adaptable, and there were very few people who were adaptable at that point in time in our team, who could adapt to the newer situation and then start learning and start fixing things.
So how do you figure, I mean, how do you figure it out? Like, I mean, how does one figure out if, let's say I'm going for an interview tomorrow. I won't be able to adapt, but how would you know that I'm adaptable or no?
Oh, it's very difficult. Like, I still get the same questions right now because I keep talking about this mistake again and again. I think one best measure is to have in-depth understanding what that person has done in the past, right? And what are the challenges that the person has faced, and how did he or she solve that is the best indicator. Another thing that I do rigorously right now is go and talk to get some ref checks done around that person and see if there is adaptability or not, right? So that gives us some sense. In some cases, there are lack of data points, and you just go on your intuition and
So if, but I think, so I, if the person has already worked at a company where they have scaled, I think that, isn't that a good, is that a good proxy?
But it does not necessarily mean that these people are adaptable, right? A lot of things factor in that there was a team who was supporting constantly. There was somebody who was constantly mentoring what needs to be done. So if the company has scaled, but not everybody are in that company scaling.
So sometimes, I mean, it's possible for employees to just cruise with the scale. I mean, it's like... there are a few people who might do a lot of heavy lifting, and I may just, let's say, cruise along the way. And,
yeah, I think that's the example, right? When you have enough money, which was 2-4 years back when there was a lot of VC money available, scaling at that point in time was very easy for everybody, right? Anybody could scale. But when you have constraints, scaling in that is the real task, right? And that's the person that I call is really a scalable person.
Just on, just to touch, linger on this one more, in the sense that how do you know, like how does a person break apart? Like how does a person fall apart when they are not able to scale? Like what happens? Like, I mean, let's say, I don't know, a software engineering role or a business role, is it that they are not able to, is it that this is, it just, they get overwhelmed by the pressure, or like what happens during that breakdown?
I'll tell you, like level zero. There are a lot of people who don't understand, even understand that something is breaking. I think that's the first level. That things are scaling and breaking, but that person doesn't even know that things are breaking and scaling. So I think having that self-awareness is the most important factor that, okay, I'm doing certain things and it's not working the way it should, it's supposed to work. So I think that's the first level. If you have that awareness, I think that's where the problem solving becomes very easy. Right. If you have that self-awareness, I've seen a lot of people reaching out to their managers or to me saying that, okay, this is not how it's supposed to work, and this is what is happening, what needs to be done. And because they are self-aware, because they know that things are breaking, they are also very open to hear, get the feedback, what are the new ideas, how to solve it. And a lot of people go back and try to implement that and solve and learn basis that. But I believe the most important thing is a self-awareness here, just to realize that it's not breaking.
Do you think such people, I mean, do you think, not to be such people, but I mean, is that something that can be taught, or do you think it's very difficult to get that point across?
I found it very difficult to teach to people. But I'm sure there will be.
Oh my God, you have to. I thought you were going to be brutal, but you went to you said brutal things and then you ended up being diplomatic. Okay.
No. But I think for me, it's very it was very difficult. Also, maybe because of I'm a little impatient versus some other folks.
So I think I'm reading from your LinkedIn. Two kinds of people are good at forcing mistakes: those who have learned at their own expense, and the clever people who learn a great deal at the expense of others. The second kind of person does reference checks before hiring or joining a team. Unquote. Why do you think doing reference checks is important?
I think one point I mentioned is that asking, like, the people who have worked with the person that you are supposed to be hiring will give you a very holistic view, which is very difficult to get it from just 1 or 2 hours of interview.
I'm really sorry. Just to push back in the sense, but how can you be sure that, let's say I'm working at a company and I'm working at a team. My teammates will have some loyalty to me, right? I mean, even though they may hate me, I think there will be some that, you know, now he's left the company, he's leaving the company, so it's best I don't let him leave in peace. And so my worry is like, how sure are you that you will get a good feedback?
Yeah, so I think there are two ways you can solve this, right? Obviously, you don't do one ref checks, there are multiple ref checks that happen. Not only with the manager, but with the team members or with the reportees and a lot of the such things, right? So something will come out as a red flag when you do multiple rep checks, that's one. And second is, how do you ask the question is also very critical. right? I have seen a lot of places where people are giving a very good ref check about a person. But when I start asking that, okay, let's say for Ryan, tell me what is an area of development that you have given as a feedback to him in the past, is when people start talking. Okay, I've told him this. Then why did you tell him that? And then where are the mistakes that happened? Has it improved, not improved? Because then beyond the point, people also will not lie, right? So that's, I think it's also that art of asking the right question and getting multiple ref checks, not just rely on one.
You think this model will scale though? I mean, I find, is it scalable?
No, it shouldn't be scalable because you are not building a large team. You are building a core team of maybe few people. And if they are hired right, then you can be okay that, okay, they will hire the right people.
Understood. No, that's fair. That's fair. Sure. What is a good company culture according to you? And how does one go about building one?
Oh, for me, I think the only one definition of a good culture is how the feedback is communicated within the company. If the feedback between managers, the feedback between peers, the feedback between reportee and manager, manager and reportee, I think what is the channel, at what frequency it happens, and what is the honesty in that feedback defines the culture. Everything else is secondary.
So you're worried the managers are worried the managers are not power tripping, and you know they get the feedback, and is that the concern? Or
no, I'm just saying that if you have that open culture of sharing the feedback without worrying too much, is where I will say that the company has built a right culture, because that's where people, a lot of self-aware people, will have a lot of opportunities to learn, to improve, and to build great things. But for that, you need the constant and honest feedback, right? Everything.
How is it implemented? I mean, is it like one-on-one sessions every quarter, or is it just being candid every day in like, let's say, stand-up meetings? Is that how does it manifest itself?
It depends on the maybe the stage of the company as well, like where you are. When we started the company, we were doing it very real time. Like, okay, this is working, this is not working. Like every day, the conversations were happening. Obviously, over time, these conversations are not so frequent with everybody right now. So then it doesn't happen at that frequency. But I believe the only way to do this, whether it's quarterly, monthly, is do it real time. If you are having a quarterly review with a particular team, which is just meeting you quarterly, just give the feedback immediately. Don't wait for the next quarter or the performance cycle to do this. So just ensuring that you and your reportees are doing it real time, it'll automatically reciprocate to everybody.
What stops, do you think, people from giving feedback? Is it like a vicious circle where people don't give feedback, people hesitate to give feedback, that's why no one gives feedback? Or is that the circle? Or
So why people don't give real-time feedback is because I don't know if people really in their head are clear whether there is a feedback or not. Like whether should they go and tell this to somebody that, okay, I like this, I didn't like this, I understood this, I didn't understand this. So that's very important for somebody. And that's where I believe, like, I think once somebody can understand that, okay, this is a feedback which I have to tell, a lot of people sometimes come with a very transactional feedback, right? So that doesn't help. It's just you're giving feedback for the sake of giving feedback. It has to be really helpful for somebody. And sometimes we feel that the feedback that we are giving will not be helpful for the person, and hence you just refrain from giving the feedback. I think that's not the way. You just start giving the feedback, you will learn on your own that, okay, this is not the right feedback, this is the right feedback.
Yeah, I mean, I can relate to this in the sense that logically, when you say if I'm joining a company and if I see my coworkers giving feedback to, let's say, the manager, and without any hesitation and, you know, being brutal or being very honest, then I get a signal that this kind of behavior is okay. And, you know, even I can expect feedback and I can also give feedback. Where I think if you're being very diplomatic and, you know, you know the work is bad, but you're still being diplomatic, then you know what to do next time. You'll also be diplomatic and you'll say, you know. So, yeah. I've heard you mention, quote unquote, bias to action a lot. How important do you think it is to have a bias for action? Any examples, any specific examples you can share where maybe it helped you or maybe it caused a lot of harm, it burnt you?
I think bias for action for me is more to learn very quickly. I think there are a lot of people, and especially why it works for me. I work, I've seen a lot of improvement in my work is because of the feedback. And that feedback comes if my output is much faster. Right? If you start doing certain things, if I go to the market, show it to the customers, customers will give me feedback, I'll improve. Then I believe there are a lot of smart people who can just think on their own and are able to achieve 80-90% of the good outcome in the first go itself. So for people like me, I believe the bias for action works really well. Like every prototype that we build at Stable Money, whatever it is, right? I just quickly call a few customers or I reach out to a few friends, just show it to them, ask the feedback and come back and iterate on some of those things. And in most of the cases, it has worked. So by the time we ship it, I think it's that 70-80% kind of work done. So in such cases, I believe the bias for action works for people like me.
Right. No burning examples. Okay. All right. So you have been the co-founder twice. I think one during, I think earlier mentioned Truce and now, of course, Stable Money. What do you think it takes to build good founder relations?
Sorry, what it takes to build good?
Founder relations.
So, between founders or founders?
Between founders. Between founders.
See, I think my answer, you should please dilute this. This won't be applicable. For me, knowing person for a long period of time and having trust is very important. That's why both of my co-founders are very dear friends from college, where I know both of them for maybe now 15 years right now. Because I need to have not multiple threads in running into my head, right? When I'm talking to my co-founder, I just want to be very plain, honest. What they have seen me 10, 15 years back is how I want to talk to them. And that's the relationship I cherish a lot between founders. So for me, over and above the compatibility, over and above what are the roles you are playing and if you are good in those skill sets or not, I think that trust or comfort is very important. That's how I work on the co-founders. But I know a lot of people have different frameworks to find the right co-founders.
Are you also the CEO of Stable Money or?
Oh, no. So both of us are equal stake co-founders and there's no title that we have. But I look into business and product. My co-founder Harish Reddy looks into engineering and investment side.
Understood. The reason I brought that up is because you were the CEO of, I think, Navi Mutual Fund. And because I didn't see on LinkedIn of any CEO resignation, so was kind of curious as to why you had to, why you didn't, like, how do I put this? Like, if I have run a company before, I would like to probably run the company again. So I didn't see that. So any particular reasoning there or was it just like?
No, I'm like, I'm still running the company. Harish is still running the company. We just don't have title because we don't feel there is any need to have titles right now. It puts.
But doesn't that? I mean, doesn't it keep popping up? Like how I asked, and you know, don't people just keep asking? Isn't that a hassle?
Oh, this is actually the first time somebody asked me this in the last 8 months.
Okay.
But yeah. Nobody asked.
Right. I think I'm a bit nosy than most people. My apologies. All right. After closing your first venture, what are the things you learned about being a first-time founder?
Oh, being a first-time founder is a very painful time. And I think one thing other than the whole mistakes and everything, right? I really feel that you need to have a good support system with you. The people who are mentoring you constantly throughout this journey is very important, which I believe both of us, like me and my co-founder, lacked at that point in time. Also because we were too busy into doing our own work and solving the issues that were happening. But I think that's the one difference that I've seen people who have made it really big on the first time versus who have not, is they have this right mentorship support system along with them.
You mentioned painful. In what ways, though? I mean, how is it painful?
Oh, it's obviously too much stress when things are not working well and you don't know what is the way forward. You don't know what you need to work upon tomorrow. And when after a long period of time, let's say quarter, 6 months, you still feel that you have not moved an inch in terms of business, numbers, learnings, right? It becomes painful in that aspect. And not everybody understands the pain of the founder that you talk to, right? So I think you have only very few set of people who you can talk to who will really resonate with the challenges that you're facing. So yeah, in that ways, it's really painful.
It's the uncertainty, is it? Like you don't, so you want to build something, but one is you don't have clarity on what to build and you're not able to figure out where the, like, you're not able to, I mean, there's obviously uncertainty after building as well, because you don't know if it'll work or not. So is that all?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think uncertainty is the best, like one single word which defines it. Things are so uncertain that it creates a lot of discomfort.
But that's what you signed up for, right? I mean, so in the sense that it's still a big shock, is it? Like, even after you know that,
you know, that's what you signed up for, and I'm saying that. But then, I think it's also okay to have a little discomfort or have a little pain. That's what you signed up for. But that does not mean that you will not have a discomfort or you'll not feel pain.
No. I agree. I think I misspoke in the sense that, what I was trying to say was, since you signed up for it, it doesn't make the pain less, is it? Like, you know, sometimes when you go to watch a horror movie, you know you're watching a horror movie that eases the pain when you're getting scared. You know what I'm saying? This is a horror movie, so I'll just get through. So that information is not help, does not help a lot, is it?
No, so I think you have signed up for, but the real thing is when rubber hits the road, right? I know that things will be uncertain and I want to be the co-founder. But when it really hits you is when you realize that, okay, how it feels, right? That's the only difference I see, and that's why you don't, because you have signed up for it and you know that, okay, this will come, you don't quit, but you realize the depth of that pain or discomfort is when it hits you.
So what does one do? Like, I mean, how to cope with this pain? Like, I mean, is it just working? There's a famous Elon Musk saying, I think, when you're going through hell, keep going. So is that how it is? Like, keep going through this
pain? Yeah, keep going, but have somebody by your side, right? Not to the hell, but have somebody by your side who will keep giving you the direction in terms of, okay, what needs? Because one small change in the slope will change the entire area under the curve, right? And who is giving you that right slope is very important. And so have certain set of people. And today also, right, like when I'm doing things, things are not like, oh, everything is very fine because you're a second time founder. It's just that I have set of people that I know that to reach out at the right point in time so that it doesn't, it helps me faster.
They give you advice or they give you mentorship. I mean, some emotional.
Well, ask the right question. Nobody, to be very honest, a real good mentor will not give you a direct answer. Just do this, right? That's not the answer because the situation is very different. But asking, they keep asking me the right question that, okay, why this is happening? Why do you feel this? Why somebody did this? Why it is not working? How will you figure it out, right? And then I think on my own, I figure out some of the solutions to the challenges that I've been facing.
So one is the pain. Is there anything else that is, uncertain is one thing, but I mean, with uncertainty, I mean, we are equating, obviously, you know, where the money's coming, revenues, how to hire, what's the product. Is there anything else that is maybe in the founder's mind, which I may not think of, like something very weird, which even including investor relations, like that is also included. But beside that, is there anything else?
I think sometimes we, like, founders take it too personally, like everybody, including me, we take it too personally that, oh, we have to make it work. Everybody's watching us. If it doesn't work, it'll put a shame on our name and all such things. And that puts some additional pressure on us. I've still not overcome it, but that's another thing. Like, we feel that everybody is watching us and too much is at stake. So that's also another piece that I feel. At least I went through, or some of the founders that I know went through.
Psychological, very psychological.
Yeah, very psychological.
So you started your first venture in 2015 when there was no Shark Tank in India and no unicorns every month. So how have things changed about starting a business in 2023 as opposed to 2015?
I think one important piece is, first, family understands, a lot of family and parents and spouses, they understand startup culture very well. So it has become easy to break that barrier to convince your, in your primary circle, that you want to start something and do something of your own. That has changed significantly. That was not there in 2015.
I'm so sorry. So just to push back, in the sense that, but my understanding is, you're from a top college. So your colleagues would have, a lot of your colleagues would have gone into a lot of business. So was that still a big factor for you guys? I mean, for you personally, or maybe your colleagues?
No. So I think even in 2015, there were very few startups, and they were there, but those startups were not so big for people to really, everybody to understand. Like, I know Ola came from us, Housing came from us, Tiny Owl came from us. A lot of good startup came from IITs, but they were not so big at that point in time, right? Or nobody actually made it big, like companies becoming unicorn, people getting money, and all of those things, right? That never happened. So still, to family and parents, it was a little unheard of. And that too, when you are leaving a good job to start something, right? I was in Geneva for a couple of years before starting up. Leaving that place to come back to India and starting up was a very painful decision for my parents. Like, why are you doing this? But this time it was smooth.
Fair enough. So, I don't know where I came across this, either LinkedIn or Twitter, but so I'm quoting you, the more I give up trying to be right, the better the outcomes get for everyone. How, unquote, how do you put this in practice? Like, what does this mean, like, in maybe day-to-day management?
Also, just one thing that I've started doing to ensure this happens is active listening. I think there is so much of urge in me to come and correct people, to have a point of view on everything that has been spoken about. Just to say that, okay, I'm thinking it differently. Maybe you're thinking it wrong. I want to be right. Or if these things work, it's happening as I said. I'm consciously trying to avoid to give a point of view. And even if I give a point of view, I want to give it very subtly, that you take it, but still decide what you want to do. So active listening is one practice that I'm doing, still not there, to make sure, like, just to ensure this issue doesn't happen.
Understood. You have been a chief of staff at Navi. Can you maybe describe the role? Why is it important? What does a chief of staff do?
So chief of staff, like, as the role itself, works very closely with the executive that you are working with, right? So everything that executive does, you are somewhere or the other involved into that. But this role varies a lot by every person that you work with, right? There are people who want chief of staff to be involved in every activity that the person is working on. there are some roles in which the person loops in whenever things break. She loops in the chief of staff. Or in some cases, it's just the program management kind of role, right? Which is managing so that nothing breaks, everything is happening on time, and to maximize the productivity for the person. Right. So I think the role varies a lot person to person.
Right. So you, as I mentioned earlier, you were the CEO of Navi Mutual Fund. I want to ask you, was there ever a feeling of working under the shadow of Sachin, even though you were the CEO?
No, because I think first, I believe there was a lot to learn. Like, I was still not confident that I deserved that role to be the CEO. I think there's a lot of faith from Sachin on giving me that opportunity. And I still believe there are a lot of things that he does really well, which I need to learn and master. So there was never such feeling of still being the CEO and working under Sachin's shadow. Because also there is a lot of freedom working with him, right? He gives you a very long rope to go try certain things, make mistakes, come back, and reiterate on that. So when you work on things day to day, you don't feel this.
Right. I mean, the thing is, like, I think if there is a person who is like very publicly known, sometimes that aspect can happen where even though you're working at a position, there might be some, even I think outside media wise, I think these issues are pretty common. So, yeah.
But that's for the right reason, so it's okay.
How do you look back at your time at Navi? I think you were there for about 2.5 years. Looking back, how do you evaluate it? Did you think you made the right call? Should you have stayed at Swiggy? Would you redo it again? How do you, if you had to grade those few years, like?
Yeah, no, I'll absolutely redo everything that I did post Swiggy in Navi as well. I believe me starting up now, a lot of that has come from my stint at Navi, because that's when I had a lot of realizations in terms of how the companies are run, how the founder should work, where the founder should get involved, not get involved. A lot of mistakes that I made as a first-time founder became real when I started seeing things in terms of how it should be done. That gave me a confidence that, okay, maybe I should go it out and try it one more time and try avoiding all those mistakes which I did in the first go. So absolutely. And I think that the point that I mentioned to you, right, that change in the slope of the curve, which increased the area for me, that was very significant at Navi.
So I think you've been at Stable Money for about 9 months now. What's it been like? I mean, can you walk us through maybe the founding and the past 9 months? Broad question, maybe you can narrow it down, in a sense, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think broadly there were three things that happened, right? First was obviously narrowing down on the idea, talking to a lot of customers, getting the co-founder on board, speaking to the investor. So that was the first part. Second part was...
I'm so sorry, my bad. But so this part itself, I mean, you mentioned a few things, but these are very significant events in themselves. So how much time does all this take? I mean, just getting the co-founder and then, maybe narrowing down on the idea, maybe, and then investors, like, how much of a discussion was it? Was it like 5 months, 6 months, or just like 1 week, 3-4 days?
Oh, so I left Navi at around 22nd of July. I spoke to Harish on maybe 11th of September. I like flew down to Delhi by 18th of September. We closed that, okay, we want to work together. Maybe by December is when we spoke to investors and got the funding.
Understood. So the idea and the company formation happened, you're talking about, I don't know, you went to...
Yeah, so idea was happening in parallel, like obviously September, October, November. These were the three critical months when we were talking to a lot of customers and idea was getting formalized. Company formation happened somewhere in December. So, but that, like, that's whatever is the formalities, what we did. But yeah, I think the major chunk here, I was lucky, fortunate to close on the founder, co-founder very soon. But the major idea was narrowing down on a idea.
So I don't think, so if stop me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you have a product out yet. And I think it's currently at waitlist. Did you anticipate it taking 9 months or what's been that journey like?
No, initially we thought that we will launch the product in 6 months. but yeah, as we started working onto it, we are getting into fintech. There are a lot of regulations that we need to follow. And we want to build it slow so that it's scalable in future. Don't want to do something which is great. So that took us some time, we are hopeful that in next, in another 2 months, we'll have a product out.
How big of an issue is regulation? I mean, do you like have to hire a team of lawyers to figure all this out, or, and like in general, is it very bureaucratic, or are you finding the process, not bad? I mean, considering Indian standards, you're finding it not bad.
No, I think the only issue that we have around regulations is that we don't understand those regulations really well. So we don't know what question to ask and where to ask for those regulations, right? So that took us some time. So we had to get a right set of folks within the team and right set of consultant who can help us around the regulator regulations piece. So that was the trickiest part. But I think once we understood what needs to be done and how it needs to be done, then things move really fast.
Understood. So it's not like you can just hire lawyers and they'll get it done for you. It doesn't seem like that.
No, because every business has a different nuance, right? And we also want to do it a little differently. So it's not just copy-paste approach that will happen for every company. They'll have a broad strokes, but there will be some fine-tuning that happens everywhere.
Understood. So you mentioned you wanted to get the product out in 6 months, but it's taken 9 months. Why so? In the sense of like, where did you guys underestimate or overshoot, or did you? What do you think led to the?
Oh, so I think two, three things, right? Obviously, regulations was one piece. We underestimated on the regulation side. We also underestimated on building the team side. We thought that we'll be able to build the team faster. Because we thought we had few connects, we know whom to pull in, but it's not easy as it looked up. And the third piece is...
Before you go to the third one, so on the hiring, it's you're getting people, but they're not the right people you're looking for. Is that the issue or...?
No. So I think it's not easy. Like, for example, when you start thinking about building the team, right, you have a certain set of people in mind that, okay, I've worked with Ryan, that this is the person, this is the ideal person for this particular role and really want to work with him. But maybe Ryan at that point in time or that situation in life might not be willing to take this leap of faith and join you. So some of those very strong assumptions will start breaking. And then you have to go back to square and start looking for the role again.
Were you disappointed though? I mean, were you disappointed?
Obviously, it's disappointing that some of the people that you really wanted to work with are either doing their own business or was starting up again, or are not at that juncture where they want to come and join a startup.
So I want to ask you a weird question in the sense that, is it possible to remain friends with such people after this?
Oh, yeah. yeah, absolutely.
Really? Okay.
No, because I think the conversation is not always very transactional, right? It's very organic conversation, right? Okay, I don't want to do this because I'm doing this right now. I don't want to do this because if I want to do this, I want to actually go out and start something of my own, right? Like, it's fair, right? As a founder, you also understand the value of starting off on your own. The sooner you do it, the better it is. So all those things happen because I also have done this to a lot of people in the past where I said no, that I don't want to join that startup. So yeah, all is fair.
So you were going to the third thing, but let's pick it up in a while. But I want to go back to hiring. So I know that you're hiring a lot of people, I think on Twitter and also on LinkedIn, I think you've posted. How are you finding the job market? I mean, in terms of salaries, in terms of people, in terms of where the economy is today, Is it like a lot of people applying, not the right people applying? How is it? How are you finding it?
So a lot of people are applying. I think a lot of right people are also applying because people, because there is the funding has dried, there are not a lot of great work that is happening across all the companies. Everybody is just conservative right now, just doing the thing that they are supposed to do. So people are looking for exciting roles. So a lot of great people are also applying. The market has rationalized in terms of salary. So in that way, I think what our prediction was that this is the ideal time to start a company, I think is holding true because you are able to build a good team in a reasonable cost.
Are you finding, you know, like you mentioned, funding has dried. So is the investor sentiment like a little, you know, get to revenues quickly, get to profitability quickly, get to go to market? Are you feeling that pressure or?
So I don't have any first-hand experience right now because we are very far from that. But what you have been hearing in the media and some of the friends that, okay, the rounds are not happening, there are layoffs happening, companies are focused on cash conservation. So I think with all of those things in, and plus the people who are reaching out and applying for the jobs are telling that, okay, there are all the new initiatives, projects are being slashed and companies are not spending money there. Gives you some hint in terms of okay, there is the winter is here.
It is so weird, right? I mean, I think 2 years back people are throwing crores and crores on salaries, and now people are slashing jobs as if it's I don't know, as if it doesn't matter. Yeah, you've been funded twice. Just can you talk about the investor ecosystem, like maybe any pros and cons that you found?
I think choosing the right investor is the most important activity. I think we all see money as money, but that money comes with a lot of good or bad investors. So we were very fortunate at the first time because most of our money was angel investors. And this came through a lot of network that we had, like friends or family who knew some good angels and they have recommended us. So I think that ecosystem is still very strong in India, and I believe angel ecosystem is supporting a lot of early stage startup, not only with money, but a lot of guidance, mentorship, help, support wherever required. So I think that piece is really well. But yeah, so far, I think we were fortunate that a lot of people who invested in the first time are investing again with us. So no cons as such, but it's very tricky to have a it's very important to have a right investor. There are a lot of rev checks that you should do before selecting angel investors also.
But what if they are the only company that's willing to fund you? I mean, you got to take the funding, right?
Then you should take a funding.
When push comes to shove, if it's even if it's an abusive wife, you just need a wife. I mean, that's the
yeah, that's a bad example, but yeah, for funding, yes, you should.
Right. How much finance knowledge did you have to pick up in terms of in preparation for this role, maybe?
I think I don't know much about finance, but my co-founder Harish is the expert in that, and I'm learning slowly along.
I'm really sorry. Again, I hate to interrupt, but you were managing a mutual fund before, right? So you must have had some experience with like finance and the way
yeah.
Things.
No, obviously for mutual fund and everything, but that also I learned on the job, right? So it's not like I was like, I knew everything and got into this. Here also we are targeting a different market, different regulations. So it's RBI as well, it's the bond market as well. So there are a lot of such things that I didn't know in the past. So that's what we did.
So a lot of knowledge you have to pick up on the job.
Is that on the job? I still have a long way to go. It's just the beginning, but yeah, one product at a time.
So how do you do it? Like, I mean, what does that process look like? Is it like me, YouTube and blogs, and or how is it?
Obviously, I think my first point of contact is Harish, my co-founder, who knows a lot about this. Second is we do a lot of market research and survey, right? So we talk to a lot of experts who have been into that particular role or that particular product or that particular industry for a long period of time. So we set up a lot of time with them to understand that knowledge. So these are some of the things that I do initially to understand a bit about it. I'm not somebody who can just read a lot of blogs or YouTube to gain the knowledge. I want to have a discussion to learn about it.
Right. No, you're right about that. What is it like building in Bangalore?
Oh, it's very costly to build in Bangalore. Salaries are high.
As opposed to,
let's say if I have to go and build it in Hyderabad or go and build in Pune, I think it will be cheaper. I don't know for sure how much cheaper it will be, but I'm sure it will be cheaper.
Even Hyderabad, you're saying it'll be cheaper in Hyderabad.
Hyderabad for sure is cheaper.
Really? Okay, I didn't know that. Okay. What about Delhi Gurgaon? What about Delhi Gurgaon?
I don't know if Delhi Gurgaon is similar to Bangalore. My co-founder is from Delhi. He says that the standard of living and the salary expectations both are same. So obviously Bombay may be slightly costlier, but it's difficult to get a talent in Bombay right now. So best part is to get a talent in Bangalore is very easy. The ecosystem is so close that even if we are in a co-working space, we know 4 or 5 companies already, we have already some potential customers that we have identified. We know the partnerships and everything, right? So the Bangalore ecosystem is very tight. So that helps a lot.
Understood. Are you getting late for your meeting? You saw the...
Yeah, I know we can go for another 5 minutes.
All right.
That's okay.
I want to read a tweet from your account. Quote, whether you're hiring or not, you should spend more time with young people, age 14 to 19. Why?
I think this is my experience of hiring at Navi and at Stable Money as well, is that these young people have a very different approach of solving the problem, right? So, which is very new, might not work always, but it gives you a lot of idea that in terms of how you can solve and approach this problem. So that fresh perspective is very, very important. It's also to keep you young at heart, that key, okay, what's happening, what's the trend. So that's very important. I very strongly believe that, let's say if Stable Money doesn't work, maybe 10, 15, 20 years down the line, I'll be maybe reporting to somebody who is 20-year-old, who is building a great company. I already see that there are a lot of folks from IIT BITS, which is 1 or 2 years out of college, and are so smart, fast in doing things, which is very.
I think from Kunal Shah, if I'm not wrong, where so he was talking about how previously we used to value people for their older people for their experience, but nowadays that experience gap can be closed because of the internet and because of knowledge per se. So not much value add with a lot of experienced folks. At least I hope that's what you're saying, but so I want to read another tweet. Quote, as a kid, I wanted my parents to make more friends. Now I realize friendship in adulthood is difficult. Why do you think this is so?
Because I can't. I think that's why it's true. It's very difficult, right? Because you have now operate in a certain way. The way you think is in a certain way. The way you value certain things is been so ingrained now over the past. There are very few people who will match everything and who will be the best suited friend where you really want to spend time, because time is a very important factor in the adulthood, right? You don't have so much time. And if you can't spend so much time, then you need to have a perfect person. It's very rare. So it's very difficult. It's not like college where you have 4 years to just stay together and you will not like things, but over 4 years you'll start liking the person. I think you don't have so much time here. So, and it's more to just stay close to your good friends that you have built in the past. And just because otherwise finding new friends is very challenging. At least to me.
No, I think I've heard this multiple times. That's why I brought it up. But I think what I got from you is major constraint is time, and you don't want to experiment a lot with that, because since time is a scarce commodity, you don't want to give too much experimentation. You want to stick to your crowd, maybe.
Yeah. No. Absolutely.
Understood. I think on that note, Saurabh, thank you so much for taking the time. It was wonderful having you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.